You're listening to Aperitivo, first broadcast on the 7th of November 2013 on Monocle 24. Aperitivo, brought to you by the Glenlivet. Hello from Midori House in London and welcome to Aperitivo, coming to you live from Studio One and from just down the road at the Monocle Cafe. I'm Clemency Burton-Hill. Coming up on today's show...
Zarif, the foreign minister, says that we rather resolve this in a matter of weeks rather than months and years, because they know that the momentum can easily be lost and then it would be much more difficult to get anything.
From Geneva and London to Damascus and Pakistan, we'll review the day's top news stories with Raffaello Pantucci and James Boyes right here in the studio. And in the wake of that remarkable discovery of €1 billion worth of Nazi-looted art in Munich this week, we discuss the complex process of restitution.
There was a deadline. You had to apply till December 92. And if you did not, you were no longer so-called the owner of what actually belonged to you, and we did not know about it.
Plus, we'll meet Syrian artist Sarah Shama for coffee and conversation over at the Monocle Cafe. All that, plus a bit of music and a look ahead to the rest of the day here on Monocle 24. That's Aperitivo with me, Clemency Burton-Hill, right now. It's 18:01 in London, and there's lots to come here in the next hour on Aperitivo, if you just heard. But before all of that, here's Bill Bingham with the latest news.
Monocle 24 News. The man behind the attack on the teenage activist Malala Yousafzai has been chosen as the group's new leader in Pakistan. The appointment of Mullah Fazlullah comes less than a week since the United States killed the former chief, Hakimullah Mesud, in a drone strike. The Taliban's Leadership Council, or Shura, made the decision at an undisclosed location in North Waziristan, days after days of deliberation. The new leader has served as the Pakistani Taliban's leader in the northwest Swat Valley, but is believed to be hiding in Afghanistan. An Israeli government minister has insisted his country had no role in the alleged poisoning of Yasser Arafat. Silvan Shalom's comments come after a Swiss report suggested the late Palestinian leader was poisoned with a radioactive agent, polonium-210. A senior member of the PLO has called for a new international investigation into Mr. Arafat's death. Shares in the microblogging site Twitter opened at $45.10 each in the first minutes of trading on the New York Stock Exchange. That's a 73% jump from the initial asking price of $26 a share. It means the company is now valued at a little over $31 billion. More than 13 million shares were traded once they became available an hour after the stock exchange opened. It's the biggest technology listing since Facebook in 2012. As Max Wolf, chief economist at ZT Wealth, explains, the optimistic prices come despite the fact Twitter's currently losing money.
We saw a very nicely staged, managed IPO of a very exciting company with obviously huge demand. We had already heard that it was 30 times oversubscribed. We saw some evidence of it. And we basically saw this company triple off the low end of its range from just 1 week ago. But nobody's buying this at $45, $46, $47 with anything other than just getting carried away in the excitement. These are $2,000 Super Bowl tickets or Rolling Stone tickets at this price.
In a move that surprised many analysts, the European Central Bank has cut its benchmark interest rate to a record low of 0.25%, down from 0.5%. ECB President Mario Draghi says the decision to cut rates reflected an outlook of low inflation and economic weakness in the eurozone. Inflation in the zone fell to 0.7% in October, its lowest level since January 2010, feeding concerns of deflation in some countries. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says a nuclear deal being hammered out between Iran and world powers in Geneva would be an historic mistake. He's warning against easing sanctions on Iran in return for concessions. Both sides in Geneva have expressed cautious optimism as talks began. The West suspects Iran's uranium enrichment program is a step towards building nuclear weapons. Tehran says its nuclear program is purely for peaceful purposes. Mr. Netanyahu says the deal must not be adopted.
Israel understands that there are proposals on the table in Geneva today that would ease the pressure on Iran for concessions that are not concessions at all. This proposal would allow Iran to retain the capabilities to make nuclear weapons. Israel totally opposes these proposals. I believe that adopting them would be a mistake of historic proportions. They must be rejected outright.
German authorities should reach a deal with the man who hid around 1,400 looted artworks in his Munich apartment for decades. That's the advice being given by the renowned art expert and restitution lawyer Peter Rauer in Berlin. Customs investigators seized the works dating from the 16th century to the modern period and by artists such as Canaletto, Corbet, Picasso and Toulouse-Lautrec last year from the flat of Cornelius Gullit, the reclusive son of a wartime art dealer. It's one of the most significant discoveries of work seized by the Nazi regime and could be worth more than 1 billion euros. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much indeed, Bill Bingham. We'll see you again at the bottom of the hour. It's 18:06 here in London. You're listening to Aperitivo on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette er Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. See on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 desu.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
And this is Aperitivo on Monocle 24. The time is 18:06 in London, 12:06 in Chicago. Well, joining me now in the Monocle 24 studio with their take on some of the day's biggest news stories are Raffaello Pantucci, Senior Research Fellow at the London-based think tank RUSI, and Dr. James Boyes, Visiting Senior Research Fellow at King's College London. A very warm welcome to you both, gentlemen. Thanks for being with us on the programme tonight. We always have a very international focus on here on Monocle 24, but we're going to start tonight with a story taking place just down the road in Westminster, but of course has global implications. This is this completely unprecedented event where the three chiefs of Britain's major spy agencies have openly appeared before a live televised parliamentary committee. I mean, it is extraordinary. It's only since 1992 that we've even known the names of the heads of these agencies. Now they are appearing openly, not only before the committee, the Intelligence and Security Committee, but as I say, broadcast live on television, albeit with a 2-minute delay. Sir Malcolm Rifkind, who's the committee chairman, started by saying how significant this was, a step in the transparency of our intelligence agencies. James, how significant is it?
There's no doubt about it. It is a significant development. As you rightly said, until very recently, there was no government recognition of these organisations. In fact, if you take the tube to Vauxhall Cross and you get off the tube where the local maps is where you are, where everybody knows MI6 is, it just says government building. So there's still a degree to which there is a lack of denial about these things. Of course, you can't actually miss the MI6 building if you're on Vauxhall Cross. The idea that these people are coming out of the shadows and talking quite openly, I think, is an indication about the damage that's been done potentially to the security services, at least the image of it, by the leaks which have come out through The Guardian and the Ed Snowden affair. I know a lot of people look at Snowden and say, well, he's a crusader. You know, this is an updated version of the Pentagon Papers. There's a Daniel Ellsberg-esque element to this. But I think they miss the other side to this, which is that it's incredibly damaging. There's a reason we call it the Secret Service. These jobs have to be done in the secrecy. There are undoubtedly elements to what has been going on, which some people would find offensive, problematic, but that has happened all times. There's no doubt that the Secret Services have to be overseen by Parliament. They are, but I think that their job is made incredibly more difficult and possibly lives are put at risk by the sort of media revelations which you've seen coming out of The Guardian because of the Ed Snowden leaks.
Raffaello, we've seen all three of them, Andrew Parker, who's head of MI5, Sir John Sawyer's head of MI6, and Sir Ian Lobham, GCHQ director, be very robust robust in their defence of what they and their agencies do. In fact, Ian Lobban himself was getting very emotional, visibly emotional in the hearing. Obviously we expected them to be defensive. As James says, you know, they are fiercely, they view it as fiercely problematic, the kind of revelations and the leaks that we've seen, and incredibly damaging to what they do. Is there any sense that they were getting out of control, that they were overblown and do need to be reined in? And what have we learnt from the hearing today?
Well, I think your point about Sirian Lobban in particular being quite emotional about this whole thing. I mean, in many ways, the service I think that has come under greatest scrutiny is GCHQ. It was always the most secret of the three services. I mean, we all know that, you know, SIS exists, MI6 exists because, you know, James Bond's on the screens. We all know about MI5 because, you know, there's spooks on TV. So, you know, we're very aware of these services. GCHQ always operates in the shadows, and it really does. And, it's the sort of information that they gather and the way they gather it. It has, and as we've discovered, has implications for each and every one of us. You know, the other two services, they have focused investigations which really target individuals and can only do that because of the nature of how they operate. The way that GCHQ operates is a much more sort of, or was operating, is this much more sort of collect everything and then figure out later what is particularly relevant or not. So in many ways, I think it is GCHQ that's really coming under greater scrutiny. I was talking to a fellow academic the other day, and we were saying, you know, how you've got sort of official historians of MI6 and MI5. You certainly don't have one of GCHQ. I mean, yet. This is always yet. And I would be very surprised if they ever have one, to be honest. I mean,
there is the Richard Aldridge book that came out.
There is the Richard Aldridge book, and it's a very interesting read. I think that they would certainly not consider it an official telling of how their service came about.
He's completely rejected the idea that they do sort of widespread snooping. He said, you know, we don't spend our time listening to the telephone calls or reading the emails of the majority. That would not be proportionate. Mm. That would not be legal, and we would not do it. And he makes the point that the type of people employed by GCHQ focus on combating terrorism and criminals, they would walk out if they were asked to just be snooping on real people.
Yeah, it's important to recognise, though, I think, at this point, that no one is accusing the National Security Agency of doing that either. What the NSA have been doing is basically grabbing metadata, which is basically looking at the sort of the source data going into these materials. No one's suggesting that they're reading millions and millions of emails. Frankly, they don't have the time to do that.
Right.
The idea is you gather this stuff, and as we were saying a minute ago, you gather the stuff, and then you look through it and you put it through a whole load of algorithm programs, effectively, to try and figure out keywords, etc., and then look at it. So I think the idea that somehow all our phones, all our emails are being read is a real misnomer, which we need to put to rest if we can.
Raffaello, carry on.
No, I was going to say, I mean, I think the point is that they are all being gathered. And I think that is the truth of the matter. And, you know, whether I agree, they certainly don't have enough people to sit down and read every single email. However, they are gathering all this data, and there is a debate to be had. And I think that what's interesting is that here we're seeing the spy chiefs really engaging in what is fundamentally a political debate. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're talking about a political conversation here about what kind of country, what kind of a system do we want to have that's protecting us? And I think that's a valid debate for any democracy to have. And it's, you know, perfectly good to do it. And so what's interesting here is we're seeing the spy chiefs coming out and doing this. We had the head of MI5 come and do this a few weeks ago. Arusi gave a speech, which was his first sort of public speech. And it was a very interesting speech because it was so political. I mean, these guys are not seen to be political civil servants. They're not voted into these positions. They have to sort of, you know, get to these positions through internal processes and be chosen by the relevant people. So I think in some ways, the interesting question, which hasn't really been focused on here, is the role of the oversight committees. And I think the ISC and what the ISC is doing, it's very good that they're getting the spy chiefs to come and talk like this. But I think there is an interesting discussion to be had about whether the oversight committees here in the United Kingdom are doing their job, are objective enough to be able to hold these things to account. I think some of the things that we've seen Sir Malcolm Rifkin say recently, I think he may believe, and I think he's probably right, the services are doing a very good job and are working very hard to protect our freedoms. But I think he should maybe be a little more circumspect about how he puts it. He's meant to be part of an oversight committee that is watching what these guys are doing. And I think making sure that they have that objective distance, I think, is important.
So is it fair to say, James, that the ISC is also kind of not on trial today, but that people are it's sort of on show as much as the heads of the agency?
Yeah, I think you're right. I think the great question is, what kind of an investigation can we have of the secret services effectively in the full scope and full light of day effectively? Can you realistically do this? Is today a bit of a show trial, effectively? Is it a question of, well, we'll bring these people in, we'll get the cameras in here, and we'll have a bit of media splits for the first 24, 48 hours or whatever, and then we'll get down to the serious business of this at some other day behind closed doors when this isn't so well advertised, et cetera, et cetera, and we'll get to the real nitty-gritty about what's happening. I think whatever comes out today will be fascinating, and we'll go over it, and we'll spend hours analysing it. But I dare say that the real tough questions effectively will be asked behind closed doors. I don't think you can seriously have a full open debate about the role of the intelligence community with the full revelations about what's happening, what hasn't happened in open court, effectively. I think there is a need to go behind.
That will be precisely what gets the goat of, presumably it will be on the front page of all of our newspapers tomorrow, and one would expect a newspaper like The Guardian that's been right at the centre of this affair to be making the point that it does need to be.
Yeah, it's fine, open. But it's also in The Guardian's interest to do so. The Guardian has been perpetuating this story ever since Glenn Greenwald broke it. They must be heartbroken that he's been spiriting
off, earning
a fortune off the back of this, and I think it's a story to tell in itself. You know, it's a media upon media story, and I think Greenwald's going to be the one person to benefit from this personally very well.
Raffaello, how much do you think there was amongst the general public, not necessarily amongst the editor and the journalist at The Guardian or other newspapers, but actually amongst the public, that in the wake of those revelations they truly thought that government agencies were spying on them and there was too much going on? Do you think that, and how will today's events and the fallout from them affect that, do you think?
I don't know. It's a very interesting question. I wonder sometimes about this story, how much, I have a suspicion that most people sit there and think, oh, they're probably listening to everything anyway. While they're very surprised to have this sort of confirmation. But I think it's the level of detail that you've seen come out and the fact of such confirmations and the fact that, yes, they have got all this data, whether they're reading or not, I don't think they are. But I think that has sort of confirmed something that has made people worry. But I think that what's interesting, what I hope is to come out of today's hearing, is that you're going to see a more substantial public debate about this question of what do we want these services to do, and do we think that it's proportionate, the activity that they're doing to try to protect us. So far, I haven't really seen that debate happening in any substantial way. You see some editorials here and there sort of nipping at it. One would hope that in the wake of this and the sort of the more openness and the greater discussion about the role of the services in particular and the role of their oversight committees, you hope that you're going to get a more mature debate about this. So far, I don't know. Maybe I'm missing it, James. Maybe you see it. I haven't really seen a hugely public debate about this.
Talking about mature debate, we're going to have to move on now to Iran, or at least Geneva, where Iran and the six world powers are apparently making progress in talks aimed at ending this decade-long, if not longer, nuclear standoff. James, how seriously should we take the line that the progress is really being made?
Well, I think we need to look at this optimistically, but also be greatly realistic about this. There's no doubt about it that we can look at this with a great deal of hope. For the first time in 30 years, really, we've got serious talks going on about ending stalemate between the United States and Iran, which is all well and good. But where's this emphasis coming from? It's interesting, I think, that most of this is being driven out of Tehran, not Washington, which I think is greatly of interest. I think it's interesting also that the Americans have bought the 5+1 situation together to try and get this sorted out, that they're not pursuing a bilateral agreement with this. Some of you listeners might remember the fact that Barack Obama got an awful lot of traction when he suggested that he would enter into negotiations with Iran without any preconditions, as though this was something new. Bill Clinton had said the same thing during his last days in office in his National Security Strategy Review of 2000. I think that when we look at what's happening with regard to Tehran, the United States, and the negotiations, there's reason for to be optimistic, but we need to temper that with a great deal of caution at this point.
But Raffaello, how significant? I mean, well, let's think about what's actually on the table here. The 5+1, they want Iran to suspend the most sensitive uranium enrichment efforts, reduce its stockpile of such material, and diminish capacity in quite a significant way. Iran, of course, on the other side, want the absolute lifting of sanctions, which have crippled the economy. There's not much wiggle room on either side, is there?
Well, I don't know about that. I mean, I think that, you know, the sanctions, I think, of course, the Iranians want all the sanctions lifted. I think if the response is that some of them get lifted and things are made a little bit easier for them, then I think that will be a confidence-showing measure to show that one side is being serious. And I think likewise, if the Iranians make clear indications that they are moving towards suspending enrichment or towards, you know, meeting the targets that the 5+1 has laid out, then I could see this being a confidence building measure that sort of takes this process forward. I think, you know, since we've had Rouhani come into power, we've had nothing but these gentle footsteps moving forwards. And this is more of the same in many ways. I agree with James. I think this is a good sign. I think we still have to see someone deliver something and actually see some tangible progress. But, you know, all the indicators are good. And in some ways, if we want to look at an indicator, an outside objective indicator of this, we can look at the increasing tension in the Saudis and the United States, which is, I think, partially a reflection of
Israel and that tensions there. A little bit earlier, we spoke to the London-based Iranian commentator Mehrad Vazinejad. Let's hear what he had to say.
Both sides can lose momentum quite easily. And that's why Zarif, the foreign minister, says that we rather resolve this in a matter of weeks rather than months and years, because they know that the momentum can easily be lost. And then it would be much more difficult to get anything in the face of hardliners on both sides.
James, any hope that the momentum won't be lost and that some kind of progress will be made this quickly?
Here's where one of the problems might come in, which people aren't giving a lot of thought to. 3 years from today, we will know who the next American president is. Mm-hmm. Why is that an issue? It means that for the next 12 months, everybody will be thinking about the midterms. After that, everybody will be thinking about who the next American president is. Barack Obama becomes a lame duck in less than a year's time. His ability to get anything done in that region diminishes every day. Susan Rice, his national security advisor, last week came out with America's priorities for the remainder of his term. They are peace and nuclear realization with Iran, ending the situation in Syria, and Middle East peace between Israel and Palestine. That's it.
Sorted.
Nothing else.
He can
nothing
do that. He'll do that by next Monday.
Absolutely. That's enough to fill at least three American presidential terms, not just 3 years at the end of a presidency. Obama's lame duckness, if you will, could lead to serious ramifications and inability to get this moved, I think, before he leaves office.
Raffaello, last word from you.
Well, I would just say I think there is an interesting question to be had of if we're going to see suddenly a grand bargain of some sort emerge, which is the possibility. I mean, we've got so many things on the table between the Iran and US. Maybe there's some sort of structure that could be put in place into which a lot of these issues that James highlighted could come in. But who knows?
Who knows? Well, we're going to have to move on briefly. This is Aperitivo with me, Clemency Burton-Hill, and I'm here, as you can hear, in the studio with Raffaello Pantucci and James Boyes. We're going to take a very quick break, and when we return, we will be talking about the new chief of Pakistan's Taliban, plus the latest from Syria, so stay tuned.
The rugged and romantic Scottish Highlands are not the Glenlivet's only inspiration. Since 1824, this single malt has combined unique flavours to create one of the world's most awarded whiskies. The Guardian's Chapter is their next limited edition whiskey, with a taste that will be decided by the Glenlivet's own community of enthusiasts from around the world. To discover more and write the next chapter of the legacy, join the Guardians at theglenlivet.com. The Glenlivet, the single malt that started it all. Enjoy responsibly.
/7, 28 programmes, up to 10 hours of speech a day, there's a glorious feast of Monocle 24 to savour. But when you want a slimming digest, fear not, we've got the curator. Premiering every Saturday and downloadable via monocle.com and at iTunes, it's a weekly roundup of the best from the week that was. Hours of audio output distilled into 1 hour of selected interviews, quirky dispatches and journalistic coups. Plus, here again, from the entrepreneurs, urbanists, architects, artists and culinary masterminds who made Monocle 24 special over the past 7 days. That's The Curator, here on Monocle 24, premiering every Saturday at 9 a.m. London time.
Welcome back to Aperitivo here on Monocle 24. I'm Clemency Burton-Hill. The time is 18:23 in London, 13:23 in Toronto. Well, still with me in the studio are Raffaello Pantucci, Senior Research Fellow at RUSI, and Dr. James Boyes, Visiting Senior Research Fellow at King's College London. We're going to move over now to Pakistan and the Taliban, who've obviously voted in a new chief. He's Mullah Fazlullah. He's known to be hardline even within the Pakistani Taliban movement itself. Raffaello, tell us more about this man.
Well, I mean, his nickname is the Mullah Radio, or the FM Mullah, as he used to be called as well, because he used to broadcast in the Swat region of Pakistan on this radio channel where he would sort of shout about, you know, Sharia law and how the kafir leadership and all these sorts of things. It's sort of interesting that he has risen up the ranks to take over TTP. He is a very hardline man. It was his men who were responsible for shooting the girl Malala Yousafzai, who we now know is over here, who lives in Birmingham, because she spoke up about children's education in the Swat Valley and that region. So, you know, him rising up to the top, I don't think is a very good sign. I think it's not entirely surprising, to be perfectly honest. We have seen in the past when senior leaders in groups like this get killed off, we tend to see quite hard line people rise up in their stead. The question becomes now, what does this mean for the future of the TTP? The TTP, the Tehrik-i-Taliban Pakistan, is one of the most substantial anti-state groups you have fighting in Pakistan. It's very much focused on toppling the Pakistani state, as well as launching terrorist attacks abroad. And they've been linked to plots in the United States, in Spain, and even tenuously here in the United Kingdom. I think it's sort of quite a worrying sign, because we had some hint that the previous leader, Hakimullah Masood, who was just killed in a drone strike, may have been entering into some sort of conversation with the Pakistani government.
And of course, that's very key for Nawaz Sharif, who came to power, actually pledging some kind of negotiated settlement with the Taliban. Mm-hmm. What do you think this means, James, in terms of whether there is any hope now for a talk or talks or some kind of settlement between
them? I think one of the great challenges here is you look at what was responsible for the death of this the former leader. We're talking about drones again. This idea that drones have come to be seen to be Barack Obama's weapon of choice in this part of the world. We were talking before the break about Obama leaving office relatively soon. Well, a lot of people will be talking about what his legacy is. I suggest to you that his legacy is already well known. It's the use of drone technology moving forward. He has continued and exacerbated a policy which was put into place by George W. Bush, and I think which has disappointed a great deal of his liberal supporters. There's no doubt, I think, that as you've got indiscriminate drone strikes of this nature, you're going to have a series of incidents which are not necessarily beneficial to the United States. If you just start taking people out willy-nilly, as it appears they're doing effectively, you're going to end up killing people who may well be seen to be moderate in relation to what comes along.
And
as
next.
Rafaela rightly pointed out, you know, if you kill one leader, you risk who's going to follow. You know, there is a degree to which better the devil you know is a concept which sticks around for good reason.
And I think he hadn't been the favourite to replace him.
Absolutely.
No, he hadn't. That was the thing. There was a sense that maybe a more moderate leader was going to rise up instead. I mean, I think the point to make is that we call Hakimullah Masood a moderate, but I mean, these things are relative.
Yeah.
This was not a very nice man. And, you know, frankly speaking, I think he had been responsible for far more Pakistani deaths than any drones have. So I think that these things have to be kept in relative perspective. And I can understand why the United States would have decided to target him. The suspicion is that the reason they managed to get information on him and to hit him at this time, for a man who's been very careful around drones in general, was because they caught his cousin across the border in Afghanistan a few weeks ago, and presumably the intelligence picture pointed in this direction. However, you know, it's also unclear that he necessarily was going to engage in any particular talks. We've seen these guys in the past have edge in this direction before. I think the real fundamental problem here is Pakistan, and Pakistan has got, you know, all sorts of domestic problems that are frankly not being addressed. And the drone strikes, I mean, yes, I think James is right that, you know, it's certainly under the Obama administration, it has gone from being a tactic to being a strategy. You know, the idea is that you can just use these targeted operations to take out individuals, and that somehow is your counterterrorism strategy. It's just not. There are so many other things you have to do to really eradicate the problems of terrorism. And frankly speaking, no one, I think, is really addressing them in Pakistan at the moment.
James, very quickly before we move on to Syria, do you think we're likely to see the start of a new period of uncertainty and violence? I mean, attacks have been on the rise ever since May, ever since Sharif came to power.
Yeah, I think it's distinctly possible that that is the case. I think if anybody's relying upon the Pakistanis or the ISI to try to bring any peace in that region, they're really quite deluded, quite frankly. There's no doubt that if you look at the statements which are coming out of the Pakistani government suggesting this is the death of all peace efforts, one wonders therefore how committed the Pakistanis were to this process. When you consider that this was the government which were basically harbouring bin Laden all along, one wonders how much of an ally they really are in the ongoing war on terror.
We're going to have to move on to Syria. The Syrian army have captured a very strategic place in South Damascus, or just south of Damascus. That seemed to be threatening rebel control of the whole wider area. Raffaello, how significant is this?
I mean, I'm always hesitant to say that these things are hugely significant. I mean, we've had repeated instances in this ongoing horrible civil war in Syria where people say, oh, this is the turning point. And then it doesn't really prove to be. I think this one's interesting because it seems as though, again, the government forces had very heavy support from Hezbollah. So we've got lots of these sort of outside forces coming in to support them. I think the fundamental point is that the rebels are really not in any position to take over or defeat the government. What we've seen is this sort of constant back and forth where they will take sort of strategic, what is suddenly described as strategic sites, and then it will be lost again, and then we'll go on. But the war goes on, and with no definitive end in sight.
James, the army, Assad's army, has been using a sort of blockade tactic to try and to slowly advance them and drain them of food and supplies. Are we going to see that throughout Syria now, do you think?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I'm reminded of the concept that history is replete with turning points. And if you look at this situation, there are a whole series of them. And, you know, if the West was really going to get involved and aid the rebels, there was a moment at which it could have done so. But that appears to have passed now. This momentum clearly seems to be back with the government forces. And one wonders where this is going to end up at this point.
Unfortunately, we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you both so much for joining us. Raffaello Pantucci from RUSI and Dr. James Boyes from King's College London. I'm sure we'll be seeing you and hearing you both very soon. But thanks so much for joining us on tonight's Aperitivo.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Лондрис, Нова Йорк, Токио.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyoist. Se on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Monocle 24 des.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
And this is Aperitivo, where there is plenty still to come on the programme. In the second half, we'll be talking to Syrian artist Sara Shama. That's over at the Monocle Cafe. We'll be talking art market economics and the process of restitution. And we'll preview what's coming up on tonight's programmes. But at 6:30, just inching into 31 minutes past, is Bill Bingham with the World News headlines.
The man behind the attack on the teenage activist Malala Yousafzai has been chosen as the group's new leader in Pakistan. The appointment of Mullah Fazlullah comes less than a week since the United States killed the former al-Qaeda chief Hakimullah Massoud in a drone strike. The Taliban's Leadership Council, or Shura, made the decision at an undisclosed location in North Waziristan after days of deliberation. The new leader has served as the Pakistan Taliban's leader in the northwest Swat Valley, but is believed to be hiding in Afghanistan. An Israeli government minister has insisted his country had no role in the alleged poisoning of Yasser Arafat. Silvan Shalom's comments come after a Swiss report suggesting the late Palestinian leader was poisoned with the radioactive agent polonium-210. Shares in the microblogging site Twitter opened at $45.10 each in the first minutes of trading on the New York Stock Exchange. That's a 73% jump from the initial asking price of $26 a share, and it means the company is now valued at a little over $31 billion. In a move that surprised many analysts, the European Central Bank has cut its benchmark interest rate to a record low of 0.25%, down from 0.5%. ECB President Mario Draghi says the decision to cut rates reflected an outlook of low inflation and economic weakness in the eurozone. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says a nuclear deal being hammered out between Iran and world powers in Geneva would be an historic mistake. He's warning against easing sanctions on Iran in return for concessions. German authorities should reach a deal with the man who hid around 1,400 looted artworks in his Munich apartment for decades. That's the advice being given by the renowned art expert and restitution lawyer Peter Rauer in Berlin. Customs investigators seized the works from the flat of Cornelius Gurlitt, the reclusive son of a wartime art dealer. Those are the latest headlines here on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much indeed, Bill Bingham. Welcome back to Aperitivo live here on Monocle 24. The time is 20:33 in Cape Town. It's 18:33 here in London and 14:33 in Caracas. Time now to head down to the Monocle Cafe on Chilton Street, just down the road. On today's show, we're meeting Syrian artist Sara Shammah, whose first solo exhibition in London, called Q, is based on the transformative effect of the humble British Q. It's on from the 28th of November. That's a line, by the way, if you're listening in America. It's on from the 28th of November over at the Royal College of Art. And to give us a bit of a preview, Sara is joined now by Monocle's Tom Edwards over in the cafe. Tom, over to you.
Thank you very much, Clemency. Yes, I'm here in the hustle and bustle of Monocle's Cafe on Chilton Street with Sara alongside me. So I wanted to start by asking you about the Q, about this work, first of all. What sort of inspired you to look at the humble Q, or the line, I guess, as they would say in America, and to look at it in artistic terms? What's so interesting about Qs that you wanted to record it in your artwork?
The most interesting things for me is representing the collective stupidity of the people. This is the whole meaning of the Q. When I do this 10 paintings, I don't plan each one of them, but I put in mind all the philosophy behind Q and start to work one after one to build this kind of Q.
And it is an extraordinary piece. It's a great length, taken in its entirety, all the different parts together. And I guess to help to paint a picture, if you like, for our listeners, to familiarise them with your style, because it's quite a unique perspective you have. You're very interested in not just figurative forms, but also in the sense of fractured images. There's a movement often within the works. How do you tend to describe your own style?
It's not easy for me to describe it, but let people see it and try to describe it.
And describe themselves. Now, it's interesting with the Q. You mentioned the sort of the stupidity of it, and I think...
Collective
stupidity, exactly. I think people will be familiar with that. But it is interesting, isn't it, when we consider in times of political upheaval, people having to queue, for example, to cross borders or to movement of people, refugees, for example. Yeah. It can be... There's a serious side to queues as well. Do you reflect that political side? That sense of risk often in your art as well?
I'm using the Q as a symbol. I'm not depicting all kinds of Qs. There's all kinds of Qs. But I'm talking about the philosophy behind it. So it's a symbol, that's it. And I think if there is no collective stupidity, you can't create a war. So the Q might be a machine for the one who create the decisions to create a war, or a tool in their hands. It's easy to convince a group of people about one idea and to convince them to do anything you want. So that's the main interest for me.
They're certainly very powerful images. I wanted to ask you a little bit about Syria currently. Now, obviously, you've had to leave the country yourself and base yourself back in Lebanon instead.
Yeah.
What does it mean for artistic expression, do you think, in Syria? How have artists responded to all of the troubles? Obviously, they may have to relocate. There's a very immediate problem. But what about more generally? What are the challenges for creating art and for tapping into different kinds of collective emotions when there's such an unstable situation? Presumably it's very difficult.
The very difficult thing is that you are living a war, so who cares about what challenge that could face an artist? There is something more important than this, that you hear the voices of the bombs every day and you see people killed, so there's no meaning in talking about the challenge for the artist.
But do you not think that there is always a role for art, even in the most difficult times? Isn't that sometimes when art has its most value, because people need to have concepts of things that are beautiful and things that are life-affirming, that are positive?
Yes.
That it's important to have art, isn't it, during times of crisis?
Of course it's important, but it doesn't change anything. When there is war... art, I think that you can't stop the war, I don't think that artists or intellectual people could be able to stop the war or stand in front of the war makers. So you have to be politician. You have to be. You have to know how to sell guns to stop a war. So not art. Art is more important than this.
Well, that's an interesting point then, because a lot of people would say artists do have that power, perhaps. You know, the brush can be mightier than the gun, if you like. Do you think that that's not realistic, perhaps?
I think this is a big lie that people would love to believe when they don't have nothing to do, when they can't change anything. People love to follow lies, so this is one of the big lies. That is my opinion.
No, and it's very powerfully expressed. Let's just talk a little bit about briefly about your style again, and these depictions in the queue. As I said, incredibly effective when you see all of the works together. When you begin to, you mentioned that you do sort of one piece at a time. You don't quite know where it's going. I think people will be surprised by that and say, how can you have such a grand vision and not? You must have an idea when you start. But is it the freedom that gives you artistically? Is that why you like to work that way?
Yes, I like to work freely. I like to discover the unconscious mind in me, or I like to reshape it maybe. And the same way I like the viewer to receive my painting freely also. I don't want to direct him how to see my work. So I think art is a freedom in both ways, in both sides, from both sides.
Absolutely. It's fascinating stuff. It's wonderful to speak to you, Sarah. Thanks so much for coming to speak with us. Just to remind everyone that they can see your work at the RCA later this month here in London. Hopefully many more people around the world will be able to view this at some time too. That's Sarah Sharma here with me in the Monocle Cafe. Clemency, back to you in the studio for now.
Thanks very much indeed, Tom. Monocle's Tom Edwards there with the Syrian artist Sarah Sharma over at the Monocle Cafe on Chilton Street. Well, since Sarah's new exhibition is all about standing online on a queue, let's play a bit of music now. This is Stand By Me by Ben E. King.
When the night has come and the land is dark and the moon.
That was, of course, Stand By Me, the inimitable voice there of Ben E. King. Well, up next here on Aperitivo, we're sticking with our art theme as we consider that billion euro haul of works discovered in a Munich apartment last week, some of which were allegedly seized by Nazis during the Holocaust. We'll be talking to the chairman of the Art Loss Register. Stay tuned here on Monocle 24.
The Glenlivet was the first single malt to successfully cross the Atlantic Ocean. And since that first journey, the world-renowned whiskey has never looked back. Now, master distiller Alan Winchester is inviting their global community of whiskey connoisseurs, the guardians of the Glenlivet, to help create their next limited edition whiskey. To discover more and write the next chapter of the legacy, join the guardians at theglenlivet.com. The Glenlivet, the single malt that started it all. Enjoy responsibly.
In Istanbul, they took to the streets in a battle for green space. In Sao Paulo, they marched in their thousands in a fight for cheaper buses. In Athens, they shouted loud to demand a better-run capital. And every week, in London, there's a rollerblading convoy that reclaims the streets for the pedestrians and pedal pushers. That's why urbanism matters, why words like density, infrastructure, and smart cities need to be dragged out of city hall conclaves and turned into a public debate. And that's why every week Monocle's show, The Urbanist, reports from cities around the world that are getting horribly wrong and deliciously right, visits the mavericks and mayors with a vision further than the edge of their desk, and asks the questions that will shape how we live tomorrow.
To me, placemaking is a sacred community process. It's about an organic way that communities can evolve and shape the spaces that are important to them.
every 20 years the city gets rebuilt. There's probably not a lot of cities in the world that get rebuilt every 20 years.
People respond to variety, and cities need a richness and diversity.
Oh, and we take time to savour the softer side of metropolitan living too, from the need for playfulness to places to pause in the melee. Presented by me, Andrew Tuck, The Urbanist premieres every Thursday at 1900 London time, and you can also download it from monocle.com or iTunes.
Welcome back to Aperitivo with me, Clemency Burden-Hill. It's 1846 in London, 1346 in Washington, D.C. Now, this week, art lovers and professionals alike collectively gasped as a tranche of quite extraordinary artworks were discovered in an unassuming Munich property. Previously unknown paintings by Marc Chagall, Picasso, Otto Dix and Henri Matisse were among the findings, all preserved in optimum condition and uncovered after the owner of the property was investigated for tax evasion. I bet he was. The total value of the 121 framed and 1,285 unframed works is estimated at around 1 billion euros. Now, it's still unclear whether an offence has been committed, and if so, which one, not to mention what will happen should the art be released onto the open market. But clearly, some major questions will be being asked. Julian Radcliffe, chairman of the Art Loss Register, spoke with Marcus Hippie a bit earlier.
It wouldn't adversely affect the price of this type of art because the art market is always complaining about a shortage of good pieces. So if there are good pieces, interesting pieces, ones that have never been sold before, and in this case, nobody's ever seen before, there would be a very strong demand.
And looking at all the publicity this discovery has got already, do you think that is going to push the prices even further up?
I wouldn't say that it would actually press the prices further up because it will take some time for many of these to be sold because there will be years of negotiation with families and heirs and museums or wherever they were taken from before they can be sold. So there will not be an immediate release onto the market of a large number of paintings. Of course, this man did sell one painting recently through Lempertz, a German auction house, where the German auction house realized that there was a claim on it and negotiated a settlement with the family and sold it for 700,000 euros, of which he got half. So there is a precedent already on these cases.
That was Julian Radcliffe of the Art Loss Register talking to Monocle's Marcus Hippie a little earlier. Now, the legal position on the ownership of the artworks is extremely complex, but investigators have confirmed that concrete evidence indicates some of the works were seized by the Nazis. The process of restitution of property has been undertaken by many who were victims of the Nazis, and it's a process that still goes on today, as this latest revolution in Munich reveals. Now, Berlin property owner Zvi Bernstein and his family had to undergo just such a process. Now based in Tel Aviv, he also spoke to Monocle's Marcus Hippie earlier, and Marcus asked him what his family lost and how he came to reclaim it.
We have reclaimed a house in Berlin. We found out about the house in 98, when a lawyer from Berlin contacted us. We didn't have any clue before. And the thing was that it is in East Berlin. And before the war, my family left Germany in 33. Hitler was in power since January. And in 33, they could leave and take some of their belongings, but they had to give up of most of their things. And then came the war, and the family lost all their its relatives in Eastern Europe. And then they came to Israel, had hard times. It was Palestine at that time. Then Germany was divided, East Berlin and West Berlin. East Berlin was under Soviet rulership, and we heard nothing about this. And the house was confiscated in 1939, although my family paid everything, all the taxes, all the income taxes, everything, and it was confiscated. We had no clue about this thing. And after the unification of Germany, the Jewish Claims Conference, the JCC, has negotiated an arrangement with the German government on behalf of the historical owners and the heirs of the Jewish properties and businesses. And my father's, my grandparents had businesses as well. And what was located in East Germany, because with West Germany, there was the reparation agreement with the chancellor who came to Israel later on. And East Berlin did not cope with it. And in the Jewish Claim Conference stepped in and claimed for a compensation or restitution of properties of those historical owners. And there was a deadline. You had to apply till December 92. And if you did not, you were no longer so-called the owner of what actually belonged to you. And we did not know about it until the lawyer contacted us in 1998.
And that's when you had...
something very similar to the... to the case right now about the art, that there's no transparency. You see, the times goes by and nobody knows.
Zvi Bernstein in Tel Aviv talking to Monocle's Marcus Hippie earlier, and it will be fascinating to see how this story rolls out. It's 1852 in London, 1252 in New Orleans. Let's have a bit more music now, and we're sticking with a German and tenuously an art theme. This is the Dandy Warhols with Nietzsche. That was the Dandy Warhols with Nietzsche. You're listening to Aperitivo here on Monocle 24. We are fast approaching the end of the programme, but before we go, let's have a look at what's coming up on tonight's programmes. I'm joined in the studio now by Daphne Denis, who's the producer of The Globalist Asia. Lovely to see you as always, Daphne.
Hi, Clemency.
What's on the agenda tonight?
So on The Globalist Asia, we're going to start by asking whether Japan's self-defense force should actually be allowed to go in and defend other countries, its allies. That's what a close advisor to the Prime Minister, Shinzo Abe, said yesterday. And it just, obviously, it seems like it's been a while that Japan is only allowed to defend itself. So we're just going to ask the question whether it's a good thing for them to now sort of move on and be able to sort of have an international presence as well.
Absolutely. What else have you got?
The second item that we'll be talking about is a big energy deal between Iraqi Kurdistan and Turkey, which is really interesting, obviously, because of the relationship between the PKK and Turkey. There's been this huge oil pipeline deal just signed now. So what's Turkey going to achieve here? What are the political problems that are going to be raised? And Iraq was against it. So what's Iraq's position going to be?
And do you have the usual galaxy of fantastic studio guests?
Absolutely. Well, actually, for this story, it's not going to be a studio guest, but it's going to be our correspondent, Joseph Dana, who obviously is on top of the story. Our studio guest will be Heidi Wang from LSE. She will be discussing the three biggest stories in China, including one that's quite weird about smuggling bear paws into China.
Smuggling bear paws?
Yeah, I'm not
for
sure.
For culinary reasons? Or
no, I think it's
fashion?
More for a business reason, but business. I mean, it baffles me a little bit. So I would advise you to tune in for that one.
We will be tuning in to solve that particular riddle. That's The Globalist Asia, coming up at 2000 hours this evening here on Monocle 24. Well, very sadly, that's all we have time for on today's Aperitivo. My thanks in particular to our special guests in the first half hour, Raffaello Pantucci from RUSI, the think tank, and Dr. James Boyes from King's College London. Today's show was produced by Daniel Giacopelli. It was researched by Maddie Araujo, and our studio manager was Claire Urban. Next up is The Urbanist with Andrew Tuck, who's investigating the current obsession of hubs in our cities.
It's not a real estate deal. It is actually saying, let's go into a building, but it's more than the environment, and it's the relationship of all the people who come together.
This show will be back at the same time tomorrow at 1800 hours London time. But for this particular edition of Aperitivo, and from me, Clemency Burton-Hill, goodbye and thanks for listening.
the Rolex Mentor and Protégé Arts Initiative sources young artists across seven disciplines and brings them together with artistic masters for a year of mentoring. For mentors, it's a year to share their passion and expertise. For protégés, it's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to observe and work alongside some of the world's greatest artists. For Rolex, it's a chance to ensure the world's artistic legacy is passed on to the next generation. 1 year can inspire a lifetime.